Thank you. Your kind introduction reminds me of what my college Russian teacher said about me. Математика – твоя женщина. Музыка – твоя любовница. In case you don't speak Russian, that's mathematics is your wife. Music is your lover. Well, I look forward to taking you on a journey to an alternate universe tonight. I'm very happy to be here in this beautiful building. I do have occasion in California to spend time occasionally with Virginia Halmos, and I look forward to conveying the wonderful feeling in this room of people gathered to appreciate mathematics. I wanted to tell you just one thing about the Mathematics magazine and to offer a plug for our October issue. If you haven't seen the magazine very much, my description of it is it's the journal that has the potential to remind us why we love mathematics in the first place. And I have a wonderful cover artist that I work with. I give him ideas about what's coming up in the issue, and he produces a wonderful graphic. This graphic is called Running in the Fractal Rain, because one of the articles is about that age-old question, I hope you don't have reason to apply this knowledge over the next few days. The question, if you are stuck in the rain without an umbrella, do you run or do you walk? Well, the definitive answer to that question is told in an article by Dan Kalman, and who is here with us this evening, and you can consult him about that answer.
And Bruce Torrance.
Another of the articles is about a golden fractal set, so my cover artist produced a rain of fractals. So I hope you'll have a chance to see the magazine. But tonight, we're going to start at a place I was when I was 4 years old, when I was talking to my brother, my older brother Lloyd, older than me by about 2 years, about the shape of the universe. And Lloyd, being older, was instructing me about the idea the universe is all that is, all the space there is. And he said to me, if the universe had an edge, then you could go to that edge and put your hand through, and the space on the other side would have to be part of the universe, too. Well, if only I had known today what I know today, I would have first pointed out, look, an indirect argument, an argument by the method of indirect proof. But I also might have said, there's a problem with that reasoning about going to the edge of the universe and putting your hand through. What if you can't get there from here? What if your experience is like the experience of this being, whom I will have occasion to refer to as a Poincarite? What if all matter, the matter that composes you and all of your measuring devices and everything you know, shrinks as you approach this edge of the universe? And it's important for me to point out that this is a two-dimensional representation. Some people viewing this might see this little Poincarite as getting farther away. No, this is a flatlander, an essentially two-dimensional being. Well, have you ever thought about this? How do you know that you don't change size as you move about the universe? How do I know that I'm the same size in Washington as I was in California? Well, we're going to enter a hypothetical universe where my hypothesis is that this Poincarite's ruler is not changing size. Stranger things have happened. And I have to insist that there is nothing on or below that line. So if you try to tell me, what about the part of the universe down there? I'll say, there is nothing on or below that line. This is a particular famous two-dimensional model of hyperbolic geometry. I forgot to say its title is the Poincaré upper half plane. More about Poincaré in a moment, but I just can't emphasize enough that this is an essentially two-dimensional model. And to fend off an inevitable question about whether this is the shape of our universe or is this some weird mathematician's construct, I have to say that the jury is still out. There are people who have some evidence about maybe the universe does have some features like this model. So it's not just a crazy model, although I think it will lead us to a discussion of great mathematical interest. So here are my goals. The first is, how do Poincarites go straight? In the sense of, what if they wish to travel along the straightest possible path? What would that be like for them with their different concept of measurement of distances? How do you move Poincarites around? Suppose I wanted to make a little video showing these beings moving in this hypothetical universe, and then The Wallpaper of the Plankerites, which I think would make a lovely title for an opera that I would like to see. Some of you may know some specialized vocabulary that applies here. To say these three points in fancier terms, I want to talk about hyperbolic geodesics, geodesics being a fancy name for the straightest possible path. I want to talk about hyperbolic isometries, isometries being the transformations that move things around without changing their size. And these wallpaper functions actually have the name modular functions. So if you know the modular group, modular functions, number theory, that's what these images really are. I hope you had a minute to memorize that image on the first frame, because in a way, we're not going to see that image for a while. I'm going to tell you a lot of things, and I'm going to test your visual memory, and I hope that by the end of the hour, you'll see that image in a different way. So let's talk about the Poincaré upper half plane. I'm not going to use too many formulas this evening, but I need XY coordinates, so I just figure that this is something everybody knows, is that we're accustomed to referring to points in the plane as a horizontal distance, X, and a vertical distance, Y, measured from some conventionally established axes. And in order to be talking about a half plane, I'm making that Y coordinate, the one that goes up, be a positive number. Now, lurking at the edge of the universe is this line of ideal points. I'm going to refer to these as points at infinity, or ideal points, but if I should ask you, are these points part of the universe? You must say, no, those are not real, they're not really there. They're ideal points. And that's one example of a kind of discourse I'm going to use throughout the evening, that we're going to go back and forth between two points of view. We want to think of ourselves as omniscient beings looking down upon this hypothetical universe. That's one point of view, but we also want to think from the point of view of the Poincarites, the beings who live in this universe and measure things differently from the standard Euclidean way. Can't go on without mentioning one of my mathematical heroes, Henri Poincaré. Those are his dates. It is said of Poincaré that he was the last person to know all of mathematics. So how about that? This model bears his name. There's a mathematical formulation of this shrinking ruler hypothesis. And actually, I'm going to be able to tell you exactly what that is, but, well, later. But one thing I want to tell you about his model is that it has the feature which makes it better than other models of this same thing, in my view. And that model is that these Poincarites measure angles just the same way we do. And in a way, that's why you could recognize that little Poincarite. From our point of view, that Poincarite was shrinking, but from that Poincarite's own point of view, staying the same size, but both of us measure the angles between the features in the same way, and that's why you recognize that shape as it moves around the universe. Yes, let's begin our first point of thinking about how can Poincarites go straight. Now, this is an animation meant to help you think about the potential straightness of this vertical path. What if the Poincarite, as was shown in that shrinking diagram, marches straight down that line toward the end of the universe with one ruler in each hand? The rulers on each side of the vertical line travel the same distance. And that's an image about straightness that I encourage you to hold to. And if your right hand travels the same distance as your left hand, you're going straight. So that's one argument why this vertical line is a straight line. Here's another one. Can this image help you see why that path should be straight? It's because that path is fixed under this reflection. And while I said rulers shrink as you go this way, I was implying that rulers don't shrink as you go side to side. Now, why does that mean that path is straight? Well, suppose the straightest path actually went this way. Then by symmetry, the straightest path would actually also have to go that way. And we kind of believe that there's one straightest path, not two. So this must be the one straightest path if you're going to start in that direction. Well, that's kind of an easy example of a straightest path. I'm going to call this an exceptional path. And it's a good time to use a fancy word, which is this reflection is an example of an isometry. It's a transformation of the plane. I mean, I'm taking up the whole plane, mapping it to itself in such a way that the distances are unchanged. And, well, Euclidean distances are unchanged, but more importantly, the distances as measured by this little Poincarite with the shrinking ruler are unchanged when you do that reflection. So, continuing with how can Poincarites go straight, that was an easy one. Let's think about this horizontal path. And I want you to sort of walk with me and think, you know, is that a straight path? And so let's walk along it, and in our left hand, the upper hand, is a blue ruler, and in our right hand is a red ruler. And so I'd like you to think about which hand travels farther. And I forgot to mention at the beginning that I know there are some students here, and the students who answer the most of my questions will win valuable prizes to be handed out at the end. So that's your incentive, and anyone can play. But so this blue, is it the left hand traveling farther or the right hand as we travel along this? You want to answer?
I think that the red hand is traveling farther.
The red hand is traveling farther. And why would you say?
Because what looks like the same distance to Euclidean eyes is more copies of the red ruler.
Excellent. So more copies of the red ruler. So which way am I curving if my right hand goes farther than my left hand? I'm turning to the left. So what I would say is, this asks, does the horizontal path curve? Actually, we've got a good answer. This path curves away from the edge. This path is not straight. It's actually going that way. Someone reminded me that there's a psychology experiment where if you ask people to walk a straight path in a dark room with no visual cues, they would inevitably curve toward their dominant hand. Isn't that interesting? So, you know, maybe this would be a straight path for a Poincarite who is actually favoring that red hand. But it's not a straight path. So let's try to imagine what a straight path would be like. If this path curves away from the edge, in order to be straight, we should be curving down like this. Now, this is one of those it turns out moments in a math talk. There always will be one. It turns out that straight paths are actually portions of Euclidean circles that meet the edge at right angles. Once I know the exact definition of the shrinking ruler hypothesis, once I know a little bit more about the mathematical formulas that control this universe, I can actually prove that this is a straight path. But it's plausible, isn't it? The one that goes along here was curving away from the edge. It's plausible that this one, after all, it's approaching that vertical straight path as it goes here. So let's just take that as a given, that these paths are actually straight from the point of view of the Poincarites. And there's an exceptional path, that vertical line. So straight paths in this new world are either these portions of circles or those exceptional straight up and down ones. I can't resist a digression into what was a great surprise of the 19th century. These straight paths behave very much, well, not just like, but so much like lines in Euclidean geometry. So I don't know if you remember your Euclid, but he started with these postulates, like through any two points, there's one of these paths. Well, that's true of these paths, too. In fact, those first four postulates of Euclid are true of these Poincarite straight paths. So we're going to do something really radical and different. We're going to call them lines. We're going to call them hyperbolic lines. And this produced a great surprise of the 19th century. So I just am going to step over here and review a little Euclidean geometry. And this, purists know that this is not the way Euclid stated his fifth postulate. This is called the Playfair postulate, but morally it works. So we all lie a tiny bit. But given a line and a point not on it, given a line and a point not on it, how many lines can you put through P that don't intersect L? Well, one. The parallel line, of course. There's only one. There's a long history of people trying to prove this from Euclid's other postulates. It's a fascinating history. But this diagram shows us that if we're Poincarites, then that's simply not true. Here's a point, here's a line, and here's a point not on it. And these two points do not meet. Now, they seem to meet at this point. Is this point part of the universe?
No.
No. That's an ideal point. That's a way of infinity. And in a way, this reinforces the idea parallel lines are lines that meet at infinity. Well, look, there they are. As omniscient Euclidean outsiders, we can see that those parallel lines meet at infinity. So this surprised everyone, and it showed that this is a model of geometry that shows that you can either have Euclid's fifth postulate be true or have Euclid's fifth postulate be false. There is no absolute truth of Euclidean geometry. You can have it this way, you can have it that way. And I think we are a little agnostic about the properties of our actual universe. So what mathematicians do is they deal with, well, the Euclidean model of space and the hyperbolic model of space. That was a great surprise of the 19th century. I like to say it blew the collective mind of the 19th century. Here's a little vocabulary word that's fun to know. The set of lines passing through a point, the set of all the lines passing through a point. I guess I drew this line to show there's not just two lines through P that don't meet L. There's infinitely many. The set of lines through a point, really in any kind of geometry, is sometimes called a pencil of lines through P. And I wanted to say that to set up a different kind of pencil. This is called a Hoare pencil. So this is like a set of mutually parallel lines. This is a set of lines that all meet at the same point at infinity. And that's kind of like drawing a whole set of parallel lines that are all mutually parallel. Well, in our strange world of Poincarites, that's called a Hoare pencil. And the question that I want to ask about it is, what shape would you get if you travel, if you start on a point, at a point, in a family of mutually parallel lines and move so that you're always perpendicular, always moving perpendicular, always moving perpendicular. What shape is that? It's a line. See, that was an easy one. Mm-hmm. But what if we do that in hyperbolic geometry? If we try to go so that we're always perpendicular, am I really following a line? Well, the line goes like this, and that's not meeting perpendicularly. And there's a rich new structure that is simply not observed in Euclidean geometry. It's a shape like this, and it has a really fun name, Hoare cycle. So this is a Hoare cycle. Now, I invite you to go back into your memory of my pictures of wallpaper for non-Euclidean geometry. Did you remember seeing Hoare cycles? Maybe you didn't know to call them that, but if you can call that to mind, you might remember that there were Hoare cycles, and in fact, there were many Hoare cycles. So this is about as much as I want to say about Poincarites going straight. So I think it's time to talk about moving Poincarites around. This brings up another of my great mathematical heroes, Felix Klein, who proposed an idea that we should study geometry by studying the transformations that leave that geometry unchanged. So we're going to study isometries, the transformations that preserve distance. If you study the transformations that preserve Euclidean distances, you're studying Euclidean geometry. If you study the transformations that preserve Poincarite distance, you're studying hyperbolic geometry. So he said this was the really key thing about studying geometry. It's like a point of view. And you see this all the time. When, if you've ever seen anything moving on a computer screen, then someone has used a Euclidean transformation to move that thing around. And you probably know the names translations, rotations. Maybe a character in a video game isn't often reflected, but that could happen, you know. Push a button, reflect a character, leaving its measurements the same. So this is one place that we see these isometries is with moving things around a virtual world. Well, we're going to see that we are moving Poincarites around. So as we apply this to the hyperbolic plane, what transformations preserve Poincarite measurements? There's an image that might give you a key. This could be frames in an animation of this Poincarite moving one way or the other. Horizontal translations don't change anything. So that's a pretty easy kind of isometry. You can slide this way or this way, or you can move a finite fixed distance. Jump from here to here, jump from here to here. So that's pretty easy. Now this is a key point, and I think there's a little too many formulas in here maybe, but it's a fact that dilations toward ideal points leave all distances unchanged. What does this mean? Let's start with this part of the picture. This is just an xy coordinate in a typical part of the Cartesian plane. And if I cut both distances in half, that has the effect of dilating that point toward the origin. Just cut all the distances in half. For purposes of illustration, I showed a point where the x-coordinate was increased by 1, and then I cut those distances in half, and that shrunk everything this way.
The Euclidean distances?
Yes. And really, I'm just doing it by taking those coordinates and multiplying by a half. So I'm shrinking Euclidean distances toward the origin by a fixed amount. And this really is the essence of the shrinking ruler hypothesis. Based on the idea that this is an isometry, I could prove all those other things about straight lines. So I'm going to take that as a given. Oh, here's kind of a fun thing just to develop vocabulary. How many fixed points does this transformation have? And there are three correct answers. None is one, because everything gets moved toward the edge of the universe. The point at infinity. Now, at the point at infinity, what I want to invite you later to imagine is that this line goes to infinity that way and infinity that way, and it's the same infinity, and it's all around us, and any time you go out there, there's one point at infinity. What else? That's an ideal point. That's a point at the edge of the universe that is a fixed point. The origin is also fixed. So this is has two fixed points, and we'll come back to that later. Here's too much math, but if you want to know why dilation is an isometry, here's the equation that proves it. And just first, leave this, you can't cover up things. Just ignore the denominator for a moment. And can anybody from calculus tell me that square root, if x and y are parametric functions of t, then that square root of x prime squared plus y prime squared is the... It's the speed. I want to say that that's the speed of the particle, and people who said arc length were right, because when you integrate the arc length, when you integrate the speed, you get the arc length, right? Well, all this divided by y is doing is saying, suppose a little tangent vector was way down near the x-axis with a small value of y, well, measure with a Poincaré ruler, that would be huge, right? So you want to divide by y to make that a huge amount of distance. Well, if we agree that this is the correct way to measure the length of an arc, this is the way the Poincaré measures an arc, let's submit that arc to a dilation that just puts r's. This is dilation by factor r before it was 1/2. So you can just see that if you square the r's and then pull them out of the square root, that these two things are equal. So maybe that's too much math, but it does show that dilation is an isometry.
It is a math talk.
Yeah, well, I shouldn't apologize. Well, you're really going to like the complex numbers. So, as we said, dilations fix two points at infinity. What about that horizontal translation? What point was fixed there? The point at infinity. That's one fixed point. That's called a parabolic transformation. And then there are rotations, and I haven't shown you those, and in a way, finding those rotations is going to be one of the most difficult things. But I couldn't resist. This is a different point of view of the Poincaré upper half plane. You take that line, and you join the ends at infinity and make it a circle, okay? So this is called the Poincaré disk model. You take the line at infinity, you wrap it around, join, and this is another view of the Poincaré upper half plane. So we turn it into the Poincaré disk. Well, some years ago, a very imaginative student said he wanted to color that disk with this painting by Michelangelo, painting of the Holy Family in a circle called the Rotondo, or the Tondo for short. First, we're going to submit it to a parabolic transformation. It's going to leave this point in infinity fixed, and it's going to move this one about around to here. Can you imagine how that's going to look? I call this La Donna delle Piede Grande, because it's the Madonna of the large feet. But you have to remember that before we did the transformation, her feet were already enormous, because it takes lots of little shrunken rulers near the edge of the universe to measure across there. The next thing is to do a hyperbolic transformation that shoves from this point of infinity toward that point of infinity. And as you see, Joseph's head looks very large, but remember, it was already large. Well, I'm just sometimes dazzled by the creativity of my students, and that one's name is Joe Kane, who programmed this. So, in search of rotations, we need to travel through the land of reflections. We already said that reflections about vertical lines leaves all distances unchanged. What if I want to reflect about other lines? What are those other lines? They're portions of circles. So if I want to reflect across one of those, I'm going to have to move the whole outside to the inside and the inside to the outside. I wonder if anyone knows something that will do that for us. Let's sneak up on it. I prepared a little animation to help us contemplate the relationship between translation and reflection. Suppose we want to reflect the point P across an axis. The first step I'm going to do is I'm going to slide P to the nearest point Q on the mirror axis. And then I'm going to follow, where did Q end up? Well, that's the reflection of P. That would be a good description of how to use a translation to produce a reflection. Well, I'm just going to repeat this, only instead of the regular side-to-side translations, I'm going to use dilation. Slide a point P to the nearest point on the mirror axis. The point where Q ends up is the reflection of P. And if you watch just for an instant, boom! Don't blink or you'll miss it. There is the line that is the reflection of the top one. The place where Q ends up is the reflection of P. The place where Q ends up is the reflection of P. Now, I took out a lot of the extraneous thing. You might be able to fill in a circle going around like this. Slide P to Q, the place where Q ends up, namely P prime, is the reflection. Well, just by simple ratios, the ratio from OP to OQ, that's the dilation factor, and that's got to be the same as OQ to P to OP prime. There it is. If you rearrange that, what's the product? OP times OP prime is OP times OP prime is OQ squared. Now, does that remind you of anything? This actually is just the beautiful, familiar idea of circle inversion. Given a point outside a circle with center O, you just locate P prime on this ray so that the product of those two distances is the square of the radius of the circle. That's circle inversion. It's a very famous transformation. Swaps the outside of a circle for the inside and the inside for the outside. Lo and behold, that is an isometry for our Poincarites. So I set up a little linkage so that I could move my mouse and show the inverted image of every point as I drew by inverted through that semicircle. So as you see, the word hello in my terrible mouse handwriting has been turned into a backwards version. This is called an indirect isometry because it flips things over. It makes the writing, it turns it into backwards writing. And I won't explain more about linkages. They're wonderful to know about, but I wanted to give a plug for Geometry's Sketchpad. How many people love Sketchpad? It's really fun to use, so I see a lot of people have that experience ahead of them. So we've identified two kinds of reflections, and we need to somehow think about a rotation. Well, in order to really do this right, I have to sneak in some complex notation for you, where all I'm going to do is declare that instead of writing a Cartesian coordinates this way, I'm just going to say, well, that really can be written as x plus iy with the rule that I squared is minus 1. The reason it's convenient here, it allows me in one symbol to indicate something that used to use two symbols. With this in mind, it's pretty easy to see that this is the formula for inversion in the unit circle. So start with a point x, y outside the circle, and then what do we want to do? We want to locate a point on that ray from the origin to x, y. Oh, points on that ray, all you do is scale. And then what's the right scaling factor? Well, I claim that it's this, and if you compute the magnitude of this point and the magnitude of that point and multiply them, you'll get one. Okay? So this is, that's not an easy formula if you put it in complex notation. It's just 1 over z bar, where z bar is a notation for the same number flipped about the x-axis. So see, that's a very convenient and easy way to show inversion in this circle. To do the other reflection, if we're reflecting about the y-axis, all we do is we negate the x-coordinates. Well, that's just what minus z bar is. Okay, so that's a simple formula. But the really beautiful thing is to compose these two reflections. So another question is, suppose I have two lines that meet at right angles, and I'm going to reflect about one, and then reflect about the other. Now, I draw terribly, you see why I use computers, but the composition of those two reflections is what? What relation does this letter bear to that one? It has been rotated by 180 degrees. Oh, that's neat. If you compose two reflections, you get a rotation through twice the angle at which those reflection axes meet. So I'm going to compose these two things, and I get a rotation through 180 degrees. That's how it looks visually. So you'll see that my hello is now legible. Well, if you turn like this, it's not turned backwards. And the formulas are just beautiful. This is the vertical reflection. You compose that with the circling version. And you get this as the simple formula for that rotation about I through angle 180 degrees. So to summarize, we've got these direct isometries. That's a rotation. Z goes to minus 1 over Z. That parabolic one is just adding a real number. So this is, I'm assuming B is a real number. That just slides things this way. And then my dilations. That's really just dilation toward the origin. But what I really want to do is compose any of these in any order. And just as a preview of where we're headed, if you compose those with each other, you can achieve any formula that looks like this. So if you've seen anything like this before, this is a fractional linear transformation. It's remarkable how pervasive they are in mathematics. And if you are catching me in a tiny lie, I admit I'm telling a tiny lie, but if you know enough about these things to see why I'm lying, then you know enough to forgive me. So this is morally true. The direct isometries have this form. Okay, it's time to move on and talk about wallpaper. Well, we need to talk about Euclidean wallpaper before we can fly into the world of hyperbolic wallpaper. So this is my idea of a wallpaper pattern. And I'm going to use it to say that wallpaper I think of as a pattern, and what's a pattern, we'll talk about that, that is invariant under two linearly independent translations. Now, you have a marvelous ability to extrapolate from this finite image and imagine that it extends infinitely in all directions exactly the same way. So if I were to slide this to there, the pattern would fall into coincidence with itself. One thing that I cannot do with PowerPoint because I'm not good enough is something I like to do with transparencies. You take two copies of this, imagine with me, you slide, it doesn't match. Ah, it matches. Okay? Wonderful minds, you can imagine doing that and see that if you translate through this length, then not just this point looks the same as this one, but every point gets mapped to a same colored part of the pattern. And that's true if you translate down this distance. So this is invariant under two linearly independent translations. When that happens, I call these symmetries of the pattern. And you might be able to see another symmetry of this pattern, which is reflection about this axis. Anybody tell me another kind?
Rotation.
Yeah, if I rotate about that point. Well, yeah, it's true. A pattern... A wallpaper pattern has to have two linearly independent translational symmetries, but it may have other symmetries, so like a rotation. So I turn this pattern upside down, and it's the same pattern. I call that a symmetry of the pattern. This has rotational symmetry, it has translational symmetry in two directions, and
reflection
or mirror symmetry is sort of all over the place. I want to use a fancy word here and tell you that the symmetries of a pattern form a group. A group is a name for a collection of things with a certain property. And the key thing is that idea that if you have one symmetry, you can compose it with another symmetry, and the result is a symmetry. So that's called the group closure property. So let's see, this one rotates too. I'm not sure how useful it is, but I'm going to rotate about this point, and we're going to yell when the pattern falls into coincidence with itself. So look, keep your eye on that blue thing being directly above the pink thing. Now, Okay, so you can rotate through 120 degrees and the pattern falls into coincidence with itself. And then because you could do that once, you can also do it twice. Mm. See, that's part of this group property. When you have a symmetry, you can do it twice. But when you do this one three times, what happens? Come back to where you started. So I'm going to call this a symmetry of order three. I'm going to call this a rotational three center. And a really strong thing about the group property is a principle that if you have some symmetries in a pattern, then you must have others. Let's do one quick example. The symmetry that slides here to here, okay, translation through that distance, translation through that distance, those are both symmetries of the pattern. What happens when you compose those? You get a translation that translates from there to there. That's a necessary symmetry. You have to be able to slide from there to there if you're able to slide here to here and here to here to here. It's kind of a wonderful fact about this particular one that you can generate all the symmetries of the pattern if you have one translation, rotation through 120 degrees, and one of these mirrors. All of these other symmetries that we see, like, look, rotational symmetry about that one, can be written as a composition of those three simple things. This is a group that's generated by three elements. And so it's fun to get to recognize the different kinds of symmetry in wallpaper. The great fact about wallpaper is that up to isomorphism, there are 17 of these groups. And my students tell me about this experience. You start watching movies, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg's got great wallpaper in it, and you're, you know, disturb others in the theater when you cry out, CMM, it's great. Part of the proof of this is to prove that rotational symmetry can only have order 2, that 180-degree rotation. Oh, look, there's a 2 center. See, the pattern is symmetrical, 180 degrees about that point. 3 centers, there's a point of 3-fold rotational symmetry. 6-fold rotational symmetry through there, oh, yeah, you can rotate 60 degrees. And 4-fold rotational symmetry. 4-fold not present in this picture, but you can easily think of a checkerboard as an example with 4-fold rotational symmetry. So proving this is called establishing the crystallographic restriction. You can only have these rotations. And so I have to just emphasize, you can't have 5-fold symmetry in wallpaper, which brings me to the question of, well, what's this then? Look, there's a center of 5-fold rotation. Oh, it's translationally reticent. So. Oh, well, I've made wallpaper with 5-fold rotational symmetry. So I can prove that this is impossible and show you a picture of it, which is a trick. And this is a material for another talk. Invite me back. It's called Forbidden Symmetries Violating the Crystallographic Restriction. And I have to tell you, it's the image that is a fraud. A clever fraud, I think, but a fraud nonetheless. Well, so that's enough. I was going to say enough about wallpaper, but I haven't told you what a wallpaper pattern is. In a way, my experience with wallpaper came from a definition in a textbook that didn't match my experience in the real world. I was teaching out of a textbook and it said, a wallpaper pattern is a set of points in the plane such that... Set of points in the plane? How is that a set of points in the plane? I saw things richer in the wallpapers that I saw in the world around me. So I wanted to coin a new definition, and my view of wallpaper is that it's really a function of two variables. So imagine in the plane, you're going to have a kind of surface, and this function shows over each point x, y, it shows me how high that surface is going to be. And so I imagine something that was deformed in a wallpapery symmetric way. And this is the formal definition of a wallpaper function. You have a function of the vector variable x, so that if you do something to that x, like a translation, for instance, and read off the value of the function, it's the same as if you didn't do anything and read off the value of the function. So suppose g was a translation here to here. That would just mean that the value of the function is equally high at these two points. And it's got to be that way as you change the x, okay? And it's got to be that way as you look through the different kinds of translations or rotations that belong to that particular group, G. So I could go on about this, but let's just look at this for a minute, that I used colors in some kind of way that I'm not going to take time to describe to show some of these points as being high, some of these points as being low. And when you see the same color, it means those points are the same height. So that this has 6-fold rotational symmetry there, and that's all. It's got six-fold rotational symmetry, translational symmetry. But once I was thinking about wallpaper functions, the way I constructed them, it was natural, believe it or not, to ask this question. Deform the plane in an elastic membrane that has this wallpaper symmetry, release it from rest, and find out what happens as it vibrates. I just solved the linear wave equation with wallpaper initial data and imposed a wallpaper boundary condition, and I produced vibrating wallpaper. And if the PowerPoint gods are with us, and people who see these images think of cell division and something organic happening. And I think that's because the things we see in nature tend to obey wave equations. So, you know, this has this natural flow and rhythm to it. So, enough about Euclidean wallpaper. If you want to know more, I have this article in Communications in Visual Mathematics. You can see computed images. Let's talk about hyperbolic wallpaper and finish for this evening. When I go to make wallpaper, I have to establish which are going to be the symmetries of this pattern. So I'm going to start small. I want the pattern to be same under horizontal translation by one unit and a half turn. Remember the hello, hello, a half turn. These are two direct isometries that will, I don't know, affect the look of my wallpaper. And, well, you've got to get all the other transformations that arise from composing these. Because remember the rule about symmetries. If you're going to have some, you must have others. Like, for instance, that translation. If the pattern is going to look the same after translating one unit, it's going to look the same after translating 2 units and 3 units and 17 units and 47. So if you have some, you must have others. And here's another it turns out. It turns out that the group generated by these is a set of fractional linear transformations. So that AD minus BC equals 1. And again, I'm slightly lying there, plus or minus 1, but if you know enough, you can forgive me. So these are, we're really looking for functions that are invariant under the modular group, which is, you just wouldn't believe how widely studied and applied this is. We want to find functions that are invariant under this group. Now, rather than tell you right away how I look for those functions, I want to think about what would they look like? So I want to engage your visual imagination and try and figure out what features are necessary if you're going to have a function that enjoys this kind of symmetry. Well, let's start with 2 rows of Poincarites. Because what we know is if there's going to be translational symmetry, you might have like a potato stamp, a pattern, 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 pattern. And again, engage that wonderful imagination to realize that this is just a little swatch of an infinite pattern. And then when you turn about this point, that gives you a row of Poincarites like that. Okay? Now you can imagine that there has to be this one and this one and this one too. Okay? So right away, does that remind you of those images you were looking at on the screen when you came in? Well, what I'm going to do is, obviously, it's a symmetry to shift along this horocycle. That's an exceptional horocycle. It's the one that cuts across the family of vertical lines. That's easy to shift along there. The thing that's hard is to shift in a way that moves this little copy of the image to there. So I programmed an animation that gradually shifts along that lower horocycle. And what we're going to find out is what happens to this upper group of Poincarites. Can you imagine it? What happens if I just shift that? So that top horocycle of Poincarites, that top kick line of Poincarites, comes down to be the horocycle next door. And remember that the original one was extending off to infinity, and there's going to be something very special about taking this whole axis and somehow it's got to squunch down into there. Well, let's do it with 3 rows of Poincarites. And now I've added, we're still going to shift along this one, and we're going to find out what happens to the one next door here. What happens to this one? It comes up and takes the role of the top row. But the thing that I think is really fun is to add one more row and to ask what happens to the horocycle next door as we shift along this part of the horocycle pattern. We're going to move this little fellow to there. And what happens to this one? Remember that this row comes down and takes the place there. It's a little hard to see, but it's getting shoved down to be an apparently smaller version of that Horow cycle in between the other two. At the end of this animation, there's a little Horow cycle in there, but I've got to ask you, is that smaller?
No.
Not from the point of view of the Poincarites. These are isometries, exactly the same size. Now, a thing that is kind of moving to me is that it's not just this one that's being shrunk down there, but all the other little Horow cycles that fit under that top row of Poincarites, they've got to somehow find room to squeeze in down there. Oh my goodness, infinitely many of them have to get squeezed in there, all the same size. So here's some of the stuff we expect to see based on our experience. Of course, repeats along Horow cycles, and that vertical one is a great example. And between any two of those fans, we expect to see one that looks smaller, but of course is in fact exactly the same size. And so just with that much, you want to see. This is the first example that I computed. I was in a computer lab at Brown University using a fancy machine. In anticipating questions, I computed these, computing pixel by pixel, one pixel at a time, deciding what color to paint it. And this is the first one I saw. Repeats along Horow cycles. This looks like there's sort of nothing repeating there, but that's okay. This is like the top row of Poincarites, the bottom row. And look in there, that's the smaller one, apparently smaller one that's shoved in there. But this is the way I first saw it, but what part of this picture do you want to see more of? Down there. That's the interesting part. So let's think about what we're going to see when we take a closer look. If I tell you that just from the formulas, those largest apparently seeming peacock fans, their bases, their limit points are integer points. So 0, 1, 2, minus 1, and so on. But when I do that sort of squunch of shifting along that Horow cycle, it takes the whole interval from 1 to infinity and all of the fans that are based there, and it squunches it into the interval from 0 to 1. Infinitely many fans have to be isometric to the fans that you're going to see in the interval from 0 to 1. So it turns out that there's an identical one of these fans based at every rational number on the ideal line. There's a lot of them. And so when we magnify, we get something like this. And you can see many of them. This is 0, 1 half, 1 quarter, 1 third. But you can imagine that, you know, at 47,320 seconds, there's one of these down there. There's a lot of them. That's why this, you know, opens up into kind of a startling thing. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about how I made these images. I was looking for functions, and so there's a standard technique for creating symmetric things. You might know an even function is a function, just a function of one variable, so that when you reflect it about the y-axis, you get the same thing. Well, if you start with any building block f of x, you can symmetrize it. You take f of x, you take f of minus x, which looks like what happens when you do that, and then you average them. So just a quick little visual example, exponential function, e to the x, e to the minus x. If I average them, and look, this green thing is just visually splitting the difference between yellow and red. The green thing is symmetrical. So that's an easy way to produce symmetry by performing the operations that you want the result to be symmetric under and then averaging the result. This is called group averaging. Now, the problem is that when I think about the modular group, remember that all those translations and all those half turns and all that stuff, well, it's a pretty big group. So did I do this? In a way, morally, I sort of did. I took a building block and I symmetrized it by moving it infinitely many ways around the plane, but I didn't divide by infinity. And in fact, I didn't exactly do this. A number theorist, Jeffrey Hofstein at Brown University, helped me realize that I should start with something that is already periodic in the x direction. That does half my work for me. So sine 2 pi n x. that has periods, you know, period one, so you can, you know, it has the right symmetry. And I'll tell you a little bit about the exponent on that y, but not much. No, we're just getting to the end here. And then this building block is already invariant under these translations, where b is an integer, a real integer. And so instead of averaging over the whole group, all you have to do is pick out one element of each coset of this subgroup. And this is really, just to tell the truth, this is the series, the infinite series, that I summed to make each pixel of each one of these diagrams. And you need to have the real part of S greater than 1 in order that this series converge. And I haven't talked about raising a real number to a complex power. It gets a little technical. But just the short story is that's what produces these oscillatory colors in the image. And there's a lot to say about using color to indicate complex values. But this is just a short story of how I made these. So once you start with a periodic building block like this, this is the basic sine function symmetrized over the modular group. Now, visually, I find this makes my eyes hurt. We know that the sine of 0 is 0, so this is 0 along this axis. The way I've used colors, if you reflect about that axis, each color goes to its complement because of the way color is used here. But you can see that, like, because it's 0 on this axis, it must be 0 this translated distance away. And then if you translate enough and do half turns, then these lines get mapped to these. So this actually has to be 0 along all of these little actual lines, which are related to this line by the modular group. So it's a very busy pattern. The first one I saw, does that look like a sine function? Well, actually, I was cheating. It's periodic in the x direction because I used the cosine of 0x. So there's no oscillation in this direction. And the group averaging makes it pick up. It's pretty subtle, but it sort of leaps a little bit up and down there. So this is the one with not very much oscillation going on in the horizontal direction. But then what I did, I was like a kid in a candy store. I started superimposing different frequencies. So a sine of 2x and the cosine of 3x in order to make things that I thought were pretty. So I call this one daffodils because, you know, it has those flowers in the middle of it. But this is a good place to recognize a necessary feature of every one of the images produced in this way. And it's right there. That actually is a center of threefold symmetry. I only promised that I would make translational symmetry in 180-degree rotations. But it turns out that that forces me to have centers of threefold symmetry. There's a hyperbolic transformation that sends this up to the infinity in the infinity sky here, and this one to there. And I can even show you the formula for it if you're interested. You do the half turn and then translate. And then you just work out that that's a thing of order 3. So you do that 3 times, you get back to where you start. Every one of these has to have that threefold symmetry as well as the twofold symmetry. And this might be, no, I'm going to use the next image to make that point. So, you know, I was just going to town with things that I thought were pretty. I called this one Klingons because, you know, the Klingon insignia, right?
Of course, we all know.
Of course. And then, you know, for every one of these, there's a fascination for looking closer, looking down here into the edge of the universe. So I computed a lot of things like this. And this is the one where I want to talk a little bit about random walks. Because imagine standing here and saying, oh, there's kind of 3 directions I could go. I could go toward, it's easier explained here. If I start here, I could go toward that center of threefold rotational symmetry, that one, or that one. At every center of threefold rotational symmetry, there are 3 others nearby. So imagine flipping a 3-headed coin and deciding, okay, well, this is going to lead me to this one, and this, or maybe the coin flip would lead me to here. And doing that at random, where would you tend to end up? No, in that infinitely kinky, weird, faraway part near the edge of the universe. A random walk definitely gets lost in hyperbolic space. And you can kind of see that with these centers of threefold rotational symmetry. Well, I feel honor-bound to tell you what the images are not, because everybody looks at them and says, oh, what pretty fractals you made. They're not fractals. They do enjoy a property of apparent self-symmetry, but they're pictures of smooth functions. Fractals are things that are infinitely kinky, and these things are smooth. Of course, if you restrict them to the edge of the universe, they get pretty crazy. But there's pictures of smooth functions. They're not 3D views of anything. You might be tempted to experience the smaller things as looking far away. That just doesn't work as a mathematical model. That's what they're not. Well, it's time to close and to ask you to think back to your initial impression of that image and how your view of it has changed. So I just want to mention some of the things that I think we can see in these pictures. There's so much room down there near the edge of the universe. Remember that thing about between any two fans, there's infinitely many that are all the same. There's just so much room down there. And two expressions of that plenitude of space fit down there into the skirt of the universe is that a random walker is going to get lost. My background is in differential equations, and I can also solve the heat equation for the Poincarites. And it turns out that heat just goes away. Heat dissipates rapidly. It's amazing. So you could say that hyperbolic space is cold and lonely. But I hope that through what I've shown you, you can agree that it can also be beautiful. Thanks for your attention.